Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Be Unique Unscripted, because an authentic life is unscripted. Presented by Bronner House Museum, Elisa Kaler, the spiritual therapist, and Little Green Oasis. Unscripted brings you amazing guests and open mic nights every Thursday night at 9 o'clock Eastern Time. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an opportunity to learn more. Visit our calendar on beunique.org to see who we have scheduled to appear next. That's beunique.org.
Welcome to the show. This is Mary Brotherton. I am your host, and I'm here with my co-host, Gene Albertson. Gene, how are you doing this evening?
Hey, Mary. I'm doing good, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm fabulous. You know, I love Thursday nights because
Yes. We
always get to meet some of the most amazing people. And for our new listeners, I want to tell you, you're among 67 countries listening in right now. And if you want to call in, you're welcome to. Thursday nights are our live nights. A lot of our shows are pre-recorded, but our Thursday night shows are always live. And our number to call in is 516-418-5651. Tonight, our guest is Dr. Jerry Bagel, and we're going to talk about the numbers on his parents' arms. Dr. Bagel is a nationally recognized expert in the treatment of psoriasis. I didn't even know that until this week. I read his book. I did a review of his book for issue 18 of Be Unique magazine, and I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. He's written other articles for, you know, medical articles, but I really enjoyed this book. Welcome to the show, Dr. Bagel.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to share my parents' stories with everybody.
I liked the way you wrote it. It was written, it's a memoir, but it was written as if you were writing a novel. It was very engaging. And it's one of those books that you don't want to put down once you pick it up. It's not a big book, but it tells a big story.
Well, it's all true. My parents told me a lot about the Holocaust when I was a little kid, 5 years old, 6 years old, and I was always interested, terrified, but interested, especially all the aunts and uncles that I had lost. But then as I started writing this book about 5 years ago, I started learning more, and I saw that there were gaps in the stories that I had to find out more information, and some of that was quite emotional. I mean,
to find
that I had a half-sister that was killed that I didn't know about till later in life. Some of the other tormenting issues that my parents didn't tell me, like the first casualty of war is the truth. And the most difficult parts of their struggle, they didn't tell me because they probably had to compartmentalize and they didn't want to tell me because it was so painful. For them, as well as to share it with me.
And what your parents went through in order, you know, just from moment to moment, once the roundups started, it was phenomenal that they survived in the first place. I mean, what is the word I'm thinking of, Gene? I'm good at words.
I'll call it. He was street smart.
Well, yeah, that was what I was trying to avoid saying. But yes, he was street smart. He was a survivor, and thank goodness for that.
Well, let's just put this into perspective to begin with. The Holocaust: 6 million Jews that were killed in World War II, systemically destroyed. 6 million. Now, 6 million is a number. But what does that really mean? 6 million. I figured this out. 6 million is every Major League Baseball stadium in the United States, every NFL stadium in the United States, every NHL stadium in the United States, every NBA stadium in the United States filled to capacity and still filled Premier League in England, Serie A in Italy, and the Bundesliga in Germany, all their stadiums filled. That is 6 million. Or,
Look
at 6 million another way? The state of Colorado, Wyoming, destroyed, wiped out. Or 6 million closer to home, 500,000 people have died in the pandemic in the United States. Multiply that times 12 times that much, and that's 6 million people that were destroyed, whose lives were snuffed out. That's what it is. So that's on a gross schedule.
Does put it in perspective.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
6 million people, the state of Colorado, wiped off the map. So I think that first the people ended up in the ghettos, which is where the Germans kind of congregated people before they shipped them to the concentration camps. And my mother's town was put in the ghetto in Plyansk, where my father was born. And she didn't know my father at that point in time. My father, I found out, had already been married and had a baby at that time. And they lived in, like, rooms where, like, 12 people would live in the size of a room that was, like, 15 by 15. 12 people. Typhus was rampant. People were dying also of cholera. There was very little to eat. But as my mother said, it wasn't so bad as concentration camp. The ghetto was bad, but not that bad. Once they put them on the trains for a three-day train ride in a cattle car with no food, no water, and nowhere to go to the bathroom, where people actually defecated and urinated on themselves, and they became sick on the way to the concentration camp. And once they got to the concentration camp, my mother said they took her sister, her younger sister, and parents to one side, and she went with the other side with her other sister, and her little sister said, I'm never going to see my sisters again. And she was right. They took them immediately to the gas chambers and then to the crematory, and she never saw them again.
And I think you mentioned that your parents didn't talk about a lot of this stuff. That would be very painful to remember and have to repeat it.
Yeah, well, my parents actually talked more about it than most of my friends who were Holocaust families did. My parents talked about a lot of stuff. That's why I knew this stuff. I mean, my mother told me that when she was in concentration camp for 4 weeks, she saw a German soldier rip an 11-month-old baby in half. Just ripped it right down the middle.
I read that in your book, and I cried.
She lost faith in God after that. She said, I cannot see how there's going to be a God if they're going to can do this to a baby. And, you know, and they put them to work. They put them to work to building more barracks so that they could house more Jews, so that they could put them in gas chambers and cremate them. It was a process that the Jews were forced to build all the resources to continue the destruction of the Jewish people. And this is on like 600 calories of food a day, like some old bread, some weakened soup that my mother and her friends would put grass in, and they gave it a name called pomoso, just to give it a name and to fill up their stomachs. And so they would eat this, and basically my mother survived out of being strong. I mean, her sister died a year later, and then she was left alone, and she didn't go to work for about 6 weeks. She went on strike, but they didn't kill her for some reason. And then she got her wits back together, whereas many other people just gave up and ran into the electric wire lines that surrounded Auschwitz and Birkenau to commit suicide. And she just hung in there. I mean, she just hung in there till liberation, so to speak. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah. Now, your dad found ways to feed Even before he was taken prisoner, he found ways to feed the family.
He's very thrifty. So, you know, basically there were a few brothers that were in the concentration camp with him. And like my father, for instance, the Germans once asked, does anybody here know how to raise geese? And whatever they asked, he would say yes, because he'd figure it out. So he would say, okay, right. Because, you know, they want 50 geese for Christmas. They want pate. He says, okay, well, for each geese, I need 1 kilogram of pasta to slip down their throats every day. You know, so, you know, 50 kilograms of pasta, you don't need that much. You know, you might need 12. But now he has 38 kilograms of pasta that he could trade to people for canned sardines, tuna fish, gold, water. I mean, he once told me when I was older that we should go back to Auschwitz because he knows where he kind of put down a lot of gold in the ground for later if he needed it. But you didn't need that. That wasn't useful then. Food was useful. So he made a lot of money there. But then one day, his brother Fryam, who was 15, was looking really bad, like on death's edge and doorstep. And he asked my father for his shoes because his shoes were gone. My father was like, you know, Fryam, I can't give you my shoes. Go give you my shoes. I'm going to die. And Fryam was like, you know, but Sam, you know how to deal. You're going to get another pair of shoes within 2 days. And my father was like, I can't guarantee you this. I can't guarantee this. So I can't give you my shoes. And then Fryam dies a few days later. And my father lives with this, you know, guilt. But, you know, to be truthful, I know he lived with the guilt, but I also know he lived with the, you know, the will to survive. Am I my brother's keeper at his essence? I mean, where do you do? What do you do here? How do you survive? You have to do everything in your power. My father's constant conscience was like, I'll get through today. I just got to get through today. Eventually the war is going to end. I got to get through today. And, you know, then there were other times when, you know, they went to work in the coal mine. There was a coal mine called Yayina. Like, there were sub camps outside the concentration camps. Not everybody just worked in camps all the time. There were sub camps. And what happened is, like, the Poles were getting paid a little bit by the Germans to work in the sub-camps, and the Polish infrastructure economy was destroyed. They had no clothing, nothing. But when the Jews came into the concentration camp, they would, you know, steal all their stuff, take their stuff. My father would find a way to get some clothes, take it down the coal mine, get vodka from the Polish guys in exchange, give vodka to the German soldiers, and get food. So he was always in a sort of black market situation to help him survive. There are times he was on death's bed as well, but other times he was able to survive quite nicely for a concentration camp.
Right. Well, because he was resourceful and smart.
And on the other hand, but right, never had more than a fifth grade education because his parents died early, so he had to help take care of his younger siblings and go to work on his own. He was like a chicken dealer at the age of 13. So that he learned all the farmers in the area, which later helped him after concentration camp. We'll get to that. So he was right. He was always thinking ahead of how to survive. What could he do to survive? I mean, he was beat up a lot. And just jumping back to my mother, it wasn't that they just beat you up a lot. They humiliated you. They didn't want you to feel like you were human. Like, they would make the women take showers right at the cross yards of where the male prisoners were, some of which were from their own towns. So these are like 19-year-old girls. That all of a sudden they have to go naked in front of men who they had grown up with. And, you know, and it's like, and my mother said something. She didn't realize this was what was going on. This is the naivety of them. You know, she said, oh, you know, it was really good when we came out to concentration camp. We stopped having our menstrual cycles. The Germans must have put something in the food to stop giving us our menstrual cycles. It wasn't that. Their body fat had gone so low that they wouldn't menstruate anymore. But they didn't realize that. But none of them were menstruating. And remember, for the 3 years they're in concentration camp, there was no brushing your teeth, no looking at your face in a mirror, no washing your face with soap and water. There was nothing like that. I mean, part of the war reparations they got after the war was just for dental improvement because their teeth got so rotten in the 2.5 years of concentration camp. Yeah, they were in concentration camp from about November of 1942 till April of 1945. So about 2.5 years.
And people think that they've got it rough being quarantined at home.
Oh, you know, it's like that. That's, you know, part of my upbringing. I mean, I don't complain about that much. You know, it's like,
no.
You know, everything's put in perspective. But, you know, I will jump ahead. So my mother lost all three of her siblings and her parents in concentration camp. And unfortunately, my brother passed away at the age of 44. My mom was obviously around at the time. And she told me, as bad as concentration camp and losing her siblings, losing a child is worse than that. So, you know,
oh,
you
got to
put things in perspective. You got to put things in perspective. I mean, although, you know, like living through concentration camp has got to be the hell of all hells. And I know I'm jumping a little bit, but I didn't write this book just because I want to tell my story, parents, and or about Holocaust, but about genocide. Why does this keep happening? I mean, why, you know, like, you know, Armenia, Pol Pot in Cambodia, Sudan, Bosnia, I mean, even now in Syria. Why does this keep happening? Why do people be so bad to each other? What is
that's
the point
a good
here?
Question.
Where is this going to end? You know, where is this United States democracy, the greatest country on earth? Where do we stand against this? Why are we allowing it? I mean, it's happening in Syria right now.
I don't know the answer to that. And
it is. It happens around the world, even as we speak.
And I don't know, you know, there are, you know, many genocide study groups, and there's many genocide, as I've studied this book and disseminated the book around the country, there are hundreds of, you know, Holocaust and genocide support groups or universities. But where is the collaborative voice and people to really, condemn this type of behavior? I mean, and where is the power? Where is the power of the democratic countries to go against whenever they see genocide? I mean, it's really man's worst. It's man at its worst.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this shouldn't happen. Not to Jews, not to anybody.
Not to anybody. And, you know, back when people were rioting in, what was it, Minnesota?
Yeah.
Totally. I'm geographically challenged tonight. But, you know, when people were rioting over racial issues, it broke my heart because I keep thinking that we have to be kinder to people, and you don't always know what people are going through. And I will never understand why people love to be contentious.
Well, you know, I think that at the very least, minority groups should join forces to stop this from happening, because you know, it's one thing if the Jewish people stick up for themselves, and they say, okay, there's Jewish people sticking up for themselves. African-American people sticking up for themselves, and say African people sticking up for themselves. You know, Asian people sticking up for themselves, Asian people sticking up for themselves. Okay, it's great. Yeah, but why not get everybody sticking up for each other?
Yeah.
I mean, that's where the power is. I mean, get past your differences or whatever you think, you know, your preconceived notions about what these other people have or don't have. And or perceptions thereof. Start talking to each other and unite. And if you can do that, there's a chance that this could be avoided in the future. Because if you don't, I think it's going to happen again. It may be happening here. It might be happening somewhere else. It'll definitely happen somewhere. I'm sure of that.
Yeah. It's going to take a lot of effort, I think, to get people to work together. And it shouldn't be that hard. I don't know the answer to that. I do want to say that I believe
that what's going to happen, I don't know, but the fact that something is going to change, and the reason is because these things that you're talking about, this genocide and these just being all over the place in all different areas, it's something that's a product of Western civilization. And everything that has fueled Western civilization since its inception 30,000 years ago, which was locking up the food and going and getting other people's food and wealth and bringing it back to your people and being supported for it, it's gone. All the wealth on earth is owned. All the people are conquered. And everything that's fueled humanity, Western humanity thus far, socially, is empty. It's gone. So something is going to change. And I feel like it's going to be good. I feel very hopeful. I don't know exactly what it is other than people starting to get along and doing what you say, I believe, getting together and saying, no, we're not doing this anymore.
Well, you know, part of it, I wonder, is it economic equality? Is that the answer? I mean, I'll be open, I'm not a socialist. Yeah. They wanted to take all my money and turn this into a utopia. Go for it. Take it all. We can all get along together really fine and happy, and everyone's got food and education and opportunities, and take it all. Fine. But, you know, there's still something about whether, you know, man is good or not. There's always been that balance of dichotomy between, is man good or evil? And, mm-hmm. you know, and I think some people, unfortunately, maybe evil might be really a strong word, although Hitler was evil. Stalin was evil. And, you know, it's like Pol Pot was evil. So how do you get the power away from evil and bring it to good? I mean, because that's really, if there's inherent evil in people, then how do you stop that from happening? Especially in a country like in the United States, where you have freedom of speech, you know, and the right to protest. I mean, how do you get this to stop? I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb here. So when Charlottesville happened 3 years ago, I kind of like just shrugged my shoulders because, you know, thinking, I got it good. What a difference does that make to me? And I saw Black Klansman with Spike Lee's movie and the snippets afterwards of Charlottesville. That was terrible. You know, like, you know, white supremacists, like, you know, with Hitler, with swastikas, and, you know, anti-racist and anti-Jews. I mean, and then what even broke my heart more was maybe 20 years ago when my father was still alive, there was like a Nazi parade in Skokie, Illinois, which was a heavily Jewish survivor community. And right. The Nazis were allowed to protest. I mean, you're allowed to protest. You're allowed to demonstrate in the United States. So how do you become submissive of really negative groups in a country that's still free without taking away freedom of speech?
That's an excellent question. I've always wondered why those groups attract so many people. What is it I know that a lot of people said that Hitler was charismatic. Well, so was John Kennedy. So was Martin Luther King. But why would so many Germans believe the lies?
Okay, so I think I can give you an answer to that. But let's put it really in perspective. I mean, you know, the Jews in pre-war Germany were doing really well. Many of them were attorneys. Many of them were physicians. They were good businessmen. They were involved in banking. They were doing very well. And society as a whole, I mean, before, especially World War I, they were doing really well. After World War I, and Germany lost, they were punished so badly by the Allies. I mean, they took away their pharmaceutical companies. They took away their ability to do iron ore excavation. They took away a lot of their economy, and they went into a severe depression. And because they went into severe depression, it seems like that is one of the premises by which you really could jump into prejudice, because you want to blame somebody as a scapegoat. And, you know, let's face it, in Europe, for the last 500 years, Jews had been scapegoats. They were prejudiced against Jews. I mean, you know, it started, they were thrown out of Spain in 1492. They were forced to live in ghettos, or at least the Italians let them live in ghettos in Venice. And then they kind of spread through the upper continent. Bottom line is, you know, they were blamed for the Black Plague. And if anything bad happened, they seemed to you know, blame the Jews. I mean, the church wasn't all that favorable towards the Jews. I'll say Martin Luther wasn't favorable towards the Jews. And there was anti-Semitism underlying to begin with. I mean, like, for instance, when my mother, in my mother's town, there was my cousin, her cousin owned a store, and the Polish people would sit in front of the store and I screamed, "Don't buy from this store. The store is owned by Jews. If you buy by the Jews, you hurt yourself. You hurt your country. Don't buy by the Jews." They would have school on Monday through Saturday. My mother was religious. She didn't go to school on Saturday. That's when all the test results or the information would be given out for the Monday exam. She'd come in, ace the exam anyway, and she'd get beaten up by those Polish boys. After the war, I'll tell you a story, really bad. After the war, well, before the war, my mother gave their belongings to a Gentile family that lived next door for when they would come home. They had no clue when they were coming home. Eventually, my mother came home to collect, you know, the family pictures, you know, blankets, and the family basically said, "Oh, lucky us. Everybody else got killed. You had to stay alive to pick up your stuff."
Oh, my gosh.
You know, I mean, the anti-Semitism in Poland was very high, and I'm sure it wasn't any less in Germany. So, therefore, I think it was a pretty easy connection in really hard times where the Germans had pretty good society in advance. I mean, they had more Nobel Prize winners than everybody else to blame somebody, and, you know, they blamed the Jews. And people were like sheep, and they captured on it. Now, you know, let me just... You know, I'm not saying Germans are bad. I'm not saying Poles are bad. I'm not saying this. For instance, when I went to Auschwitz with my son 10 years ago, he says, "Okay, Dad, we're here in Auschwitz. Make believe it's 1944. You see that tower? Do you want to be a German with a gun on that tower, or do you want to be a Jew in the barracks? What do you want to be? It's 1944. What do you want to be?"
Oh.
And, you know, now, let's assume both of those people survived. Now you're a German. You're going to live with that of all the things that you did. Now, maybe you didn't want to do that, but that's what you had to do to survive. That's what you had to do to survive for your family. And if you were a Jew down below, would you have rather been up above with the ability to kill somebody and stay alive? Or would you rather just stick with your ethics and stay down below? So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what I would have done. I might have gone upstairs and taken chances on a higher survival rate.
Yeah, that's pretty powerful. How old was your son when he asked you that question? Was he an adult or
17?
Young.
17.
Whoa! Wow.
17.
That
was a heavy trip. That was a heavy
trip.
That
was very deep.
Yeah, I know. Well, he is. He asked me on that trip, "Do you think your dad was married before the war and had a baby?" And I didn't even know at that time that he did. And it was like, whoa, why are you saying that, Rick? He said, "Well, if you look at the time frame, he would have been about 25 already. Most people in Poland, 20 years old, were married and had kids. So 25, why wouldn't he?" So then, I mean, I just want to share that part of the story again that I'm sure you read this, but that my father never told me. And I found this out on his deathbed when I looked at his medical chart, that they had done experimental surgery, castration on his right testicle without anesthesia.
Yeah.
And then 6 weeks later, 8 weeks later, they did radiation on his left testicle. So I asked my son after I talked about that, I said, "How did I come out normal?" He says, "Well, don't be so sure you're normal, Dad." But leave it to
our kids to humble us.
right, exactly. But you did come out. And he never told me about this. I mean, noticed he had a hydrocele if we went to the gym together, like it was swollen on one side. But,
right.
You know, and we found the name of the doctor that did it and his assistant. But, like, never discussed this. I never discussed this even with my mother. I discussed this with his second cousin once. And I asked her, did you know about this? And she said, yes. And she started crying. And all I can tell you is your father should be a flawed man that he is and the way he carries himself. Because, you know, he really was happy to have survived. He was happy to have a home. He was happy to be able to go to a synagogue. He was happy to make a living. He was happy to have an opportunity. And there was something about this personality type that I'll ask another question that I'm still trying to figure out with is, and this goes along with, you know, Brokaw and the Great Society, all the guys that left, came back home from World War II, many of my Holocaust survivor friends, my parents' friends, they're relatively well-adjusted. They worked hard. They didn't complain. They tried their best for their kids. They weren't screwed up. Now, why people in the Iraqi vets, the Vietnam vets, the Afghani vets have a much more incidence of post-traumatic stress disorder than the previous generations? What is the difference in the two generations in the prototypes? Because there's clearly a difference in how
yes.
people responded. Because my parents responded to, you know, all the death of concentration camp. My fiance's father helped liberate Dachau and saw the brutality of that. They were pretty normal. What happened?
Well, you know,
what
my brother
to this society?
My brother was in Vietnam in 1969, and he is probably the most well-adjusted person out of eight children in our family, myself included.
So what happened? Why? What happened to this most recent generation? I'm not saying there's anything bad. I'm not putting them down. But there's definitely been a change in the way people tolerate trauma.
And I think you mentioned that your father was happy. He had an attitude of gratitude. He looked at life.
Yeah.
And I know that in your book, you talked about how he taught you to celebrate life.
100%.
And I think that's part of the key. And Gene and I talk about this frequently, how important it is to be grateful for what you have. Because if you're not grateful for whatever it is you've got, if you're homeless and you've got a cardboard box, that's more than the guy next to you who has nothing. So you have to be grateful for that cardboard box. And I think your father and probably your mother too, they were, I will tell you, there's a reason that we call that the greatest generation. They were stalwart humans, and I think their parents before them, they had learned previous to World War II, I mean, because most of them had either been children or came shortly after World War I, they had seen some atrocious things, yet they were grateful that they were still upright.
You know, I grew up on an egg farm. My mother ran an egg farm of 24,000 chickens. My father bought and sold chickens. So they've had two different businesses and did actually quite well. And I think about it, like, you know, why does it take a baby chick? The baby chick has to, like, pick through that shell in order to get strong enough to survive. And I think what happened maybe this is the answer to what's happening. You know, they grew up in Poland. They grew up in pre-World War II, the United States. Everybody, grew up in the Depression. They worked.
Yeah.
There was no questions asked. You worked. You know, and, you know, whatever fun you had fun. But you worked. And, like, I worked on the chicken farm, and we would go out two Saturdays a summer to Asbury Park. That was our summer vacation. That's it. But it was fun. I looked forward to it. I was happy. It was great.
And you didn't ask, why don't we get a whole week or why can't we go every Saturday? You just took
asked.
It as part of life.
I wouldn't have.
You wouldn't dare.
Great concept. I wouldn't have even conceived of it. Because that wasn't part of the modus operandi. And
no.
So I think what it is that getting hardened. My mother told me that there were many Jews that came in from Holland. And Holland society was much more advanced than the Polish society. I mean, running water, toilets, electricity, you know, cars. They didn't have any of this in Poland. Poland, they're still going to the liver to wash their clothes. And they got there very strong, and within 10 days they all died. They just did not have the fortitude. And I think that it's like that hardening of your soul, you know, so that you know that the work ethic is not difficult anymore. It's part of who you are, and it gives you that ability to move on. And
it makes you tenacious.
Happens, yes. And so I think that was part of the ability to survive in both my mother and my father. I think, you know, and also then remember, like I didn't even mention this, like, so in January 21st, 1945, they say Auschwitz was liberated by the Russians. Well, that's kind of bullshit. It wasn't liberated by the Russians. It was, they opened the gates and they started pushing them the Germans started pushing them to the west because they didn't want the Russians to check out, and they tried to destroy some of the concentration camps so they wouldn't be caught. And now what happened was my mother and my father, but especially my mother, called the marches, and they would march 15, 16 miles a day in Poland in January, where it's freezing.
And some, no coats, no shoes.
No food. And if you fall down, they shoot you. And just, it gets to me, how the heck did they survive these tremendous winter walks and still live? That's the one part. I mean, once it's in concentration camp, it's bad, but you know, you have a set surroundings, you know the deal, you're getting a certain amount of food, you know what you have to do. Here you're just walking endlessly in the cold. And this is the part, they never told me about this. They told me they were in multiple concentration camps after the war, which I couldn't never quite understand, but I got to figure it out. And then it's like, I mean, and then when they finally get liberated by the Russians start raping all the women, and my mother has to, like, sleep in this, like, cattle car, like where a cattle trough where the cattle eat or the horses eat, and put straw over her so she doesn't get, you know, raped. And many of her friends got raped, and a few of them had children, and a few of them got sexually transmitted diseases. So, you know, the Russian, you know, liberation wasn't much fun for these girls. They were scared out of their minds.
I'm sure.
And my father, on the other hand, you mentioned
that when they were in the concentration camps, they had 600 calories per day.
Right.
I think that's a Snickers bar.
That's about.
I think a Snickers bar might have even more calories than that.
A Snickers bar would have probably gone for about a pound of gold.
Yeah.
You could have got some. You could have got some real bullion there for a Snickers bar. Yeah.
I'm actually going to look this up because I want to find out how many calories are in it.
But their work was terrible.
Only 215 calories. For a Snickers bar.
Only 215, Patty.
Yeah. So three Snickers bars, basically breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But how would we today feel if we, you know, if we were given three candy bars and said, this is what you've got to live on for the day. Plus, you go out, 4:30 in the morning for...
Exactly.
Roll
call. It is 4:30 in the morning. You're right. Appel. You got it.
In the middle of winter. I told you I read the book.
you have to stand upright.
And if
they knock you down, you're dead. You get chosen to go to the gas chamber.
Take a shower.
That's it.
But and they helped each other stand up if somebody was dysentery was rampant. And
terrible.
If people don't know what dysentery is, that's like diarrhea on steroids. Just imagine the worst case of diarrhea you've ever had and multiply it by probably 1,000. You're so weak, you can't even think, and you're probably feverish. So, and also, I think if I remember your book correctly, it was probably a couple months ago before when I read it. But I remember that everybody in the barracks was responsible to make sure that everybody else got out.
That's true. That's true.
If somebody was unhealthy enough to go out, you drug them out and you propped them up between you because you would be in trouble.
That's right. And then there were also people called capos. And capos were Jews who kind of collaborated with the Nazis that would be like the leader of the barracks. And they would be the bosses.
So they could get extra rations.
Yes. And when they came back to the United States, they were not treated very nicely because they were thought of as like traitors. But then again, that's similar to what I talked about before of the Germans. When I went to the Holocaust Museum, and I knew a few people who were capos, and I was going to write them in my book, but I was told not to. When she told me, she says, look, you don't know. They could have had a wife there. They could have had a daughter there. And they could have been like, you know, made a deal with the Germans, could have made a deal like, if you do this, we won't kill your wife. So what would you do? Would you – don't be so hoity. You don't know what you would have done either.
Oh, I would have gone – yeah. I probably would have been the first one to volunteer to be a traitor because I've gotten so comfortable in my life. I have a friend out in California. I have a friend in California who's practicing to be on this Survivor show. She's getting fit. She's learning how to make her own fires and shoot arrows and whatever she has to do to survive. And my son was in the Navy for 20 years, and he went through this SEER training, like SEALs, survive, evade, resist, and escape. And he actually was a prisoner of war. Fortunately for him, it was only 4 days, not 4 years. But the things he told me that he went through in those 4 days were pretty traumatic for me as his mother. I can't imagine, and he's strong as an ox, mentally, physically, everything. He did well. I think his most traumatic thing was coming home to an empty home. His wife had left him while he was gone. You know, but, you know, it's one of those things that we get so accustomed to the comforts of our lifestyle, whatever it is. And I'm not tough. I will tell you quickly, I am probably a marshmallow, but I'm mentally tough. And I would
I'll tell you something, though. You're not sure how you're going to respond to a situation until you're in it.
Yes.
When it comes to some of these calamities, you just are not sure how you're going to react. Are you going to be the tough one? Are you going to be the street smart one? Are you going to just say sit back and say, okay, I'm going to wait and see what happens to me? You're not sure. I mean, you know, you're not sure how your mind, you know, that fight or flight reaction kind of takes over. And, you know, there's lots of ways it could go. Lots of ways it could go. I mean, you know, maybe only, you know, 1/10 of the Jewish community survived the concentration camps. That's not much, 1 out of 10. And, you know, what it was about their genes, their personality, luck. Luck has something to do with it. Not all of it. I really think the will to survive is a very animalistic, you know, thalamic of, you know, reptilian function that, you know, some people got more of it than others. And,
just like you said, your father... He had a moral compass that he used, but he also had a survival compass, and he had to weigh the good versus the bad in his mind when it came to his brother.
Yeah,
you know, already.
And then later on, he was on a truck, and a German soldier let him jump off, but he wasn't sure if the soldier would shoot him in the back or not. But he had to make a quick judgment call, and he took the call that okay, the guy said he's not going to shoot me in the back. I'll take a chance because if he is taking me to the concentration camp to kill me, what am I going to lose? So then he's in the middle of the snow in southern Germany in World War II, German-occupied Germany, and he's like, holy crap, like now if I die, nobody will even know that I died. At least in concentration camp, somebody would have known that I died. Somebody would have known who I was. I mean, the whole essence of a human being is like, you know, what is my worth? Am I, there's no one going to know that I died means that I'm worthless. But you know, he made it through. He made it through to get liberated by the Russians in Czechoslovakia. And you know, he said at that time, like, his hair just stood on head. Like, he said, you know, you can go crazy. You know, you can go crazy. I think he, like, for a little while went a little nuts, like, you know, like out of his skin, like forgetting there for a minute that, you know, he lost a daughter, lost a wife, lost six brothers. I mean, alone. But yet he survived. He survived. He got through it. He had to get through it. He got through it.
I wonder what was going through the mind of the German at that point. Was he trying to make amends by saving one man?
Yeah, it was five. And actually, it's interesting because I actually read about, when I was doing my research, I read how five concentration camps Jews escaped from this one concentration camp. And it described my father, another Polish Jew, and three Greek Jews. And that's the five that were. And so, yeah, I think, you know, towards the end of the war, many of the German soldiers, the good ones, had gone off to the Eastern Front, had been killed. So they were being supplanted by, you know, kind of a weaker group like the communists, or, you know, just the older guys that were just – my mother said if she wanted to, they could have taken over the last concentration camp. There was nobody there to really stop them. So I think, yes, I think they were making amends. I think they were, like, you know, knowing that the quote-unquote, the crap hit the fan, they were going to get caught, and maybe, like, let's do something good right now, that maybe everything will be a little better. You know, not everybody's bad. Some people are just in bad positions.
Exactly, sure. And just like your son said, you know, go back to 1945, and you're here. Are you a German in the tower with a gun, or are you a Jew on the ground, you know, scrabbling for 600 calories?
And I think that I just wonder, like, you know, especially with both of my parents, you know, by the time I met them, you know, I was a kid. I was born in 53. That was 8 years after concentration camp. It's not that far ago, because let's face it, 9/11 was 20 years ago, and 9/11 doesn't seem that far away to most of us people who are over 50. And so, you know, so by the time I'm three or four, they're already telling me stories of concentration camp, and it's like 10 years away from concentration camp. So I wonder, like, you know, I could sense then the loss of their brothers and their sisters and their parents. But as I got older and as they got more integrated into American society, I felt less of the loss. I mean, this could be my projection. But then again, I'll have to fast forward. My father and my brother and my mother, I didn't go, went to Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, you know, the Holocaust Museum in Israel, the main one. And my father was, my mother were the only Holocaust survivors on this trip. And they went to the synagogue within it. And my father said a blessing, Kaddish, which is a blessing over the dead. And it's the only time I heard that my father went like one third of the way through and just started crying and just couldn't stop. And everybody cried and no one stopped. And they didn't finish Kaddish. So there was such, I'm sure, underlying loss. And as a child of the Holocaust, it was kind of difficult because I always felt like I needed to make up for some of their loss, if not all of their loss. And that was a really tough burden. Like once when I was
That's
like
a heavy 11, load.
No kidding. And once I was like 11 years old, I'm coming home from school and going up to the chicken coop to pack eggs. And my father turns, looks at me like really weird. And I go, what are you looking at? He goes, I thought you were Freud. And that's the name of the brother that he didn't give the shoes to. And I was like thinking, man, how I wish I could have been praying for him for a while. And it was just so, I mean, it was a lot of, you know, and most of their friends, by and large, for many, many, many years were Holocaust survivor people. You know, they were much more comfortable in that group. Partially my father, because he hardly spoke English. He only spoke Yiddish or Polish. So, you know, it was always easier, but I think they just felt real much more comfortable with this group. And later on, they moved to Florida, and, you know, they had a really, really nice life. They really appreciated their life. And they had most of their friends, most of them were Jewish. Some of them not, but most of them were Jewish. And
I think it makes sense that you have people that share your ethnicity. I mean, one of my next door neighbors is Italian, and she has constantly told me how when she was dating, she only dated Italian guys because she felt like that was who could understand her lifestyle.
No, I understand that. And on the other hand, unfortunately, in my community, there were some Jewish families that were not very nice to the Holocaust survivors. They were here, you know, a generation before or two generations before, and they thought they were better, more sophisticated, more American. They were embarrassed by my parents, by their accents, you know, by their, you know, behaviors different. And, you know, that was very painful. It was much more painful to be rejected by your own kind than it is by your outside kind.
I would think so, yes.
But I have to say, though, that, you know, my mother and father were, you know, very successful, hardworking people. My father was like, when he came to the United States and he started to be a chicken dealer, he would say, you know, they said in Europe that there was gold in the streets in the United States. There is. There is gold in the streets. All you have to do is find it because it's there. And he would hustle and work. And, you know, he was really happy, like, to have his own house, to have his own business.
Wasn't your grandfather a chicken salesman, too?
Yeah.
Chicken dealer?
Yeah, my grandfather was a chicken dealer. He was. So he learned that from my father, from his father. And so he learned that. And when he passed away, at the age of 10, my father went to a blacksmith and got this big crate and put wheels on it and tin on the wheels and a handle and started going to chicken farms to buy chickens when he was like 10 years old, you know, because he really didn't care about school. He just did not care about school at all. Was not interested.
Well, he had enough smarts to know how to do what he had to do, so the education part was not important to him.
Yeah, businessmen are pretty much, you know, just created, I think, in many ways.
You know,
I mean,
my father was from that generation, and he went as far as the fifth grade as well. And it was interesting because he and two of his brothers made a little – no, one brother. The other one was too young. But they made a little goat cart to sell things. They didn't sell chickens, but they sold other things. I don't know what it was. I think they did the cans and grease and things of that nature. And eventually he grew up and was a soldier in airman, I guess he was, in the Army Air Corps.
So then after the war, they were living in Poland and in Płońsk, my father's town, and my father realized that Berlin had no food. And so he went back to the farmers that he knew, and he would take food and bread, and they would transport it with him and my mom. They were a team by then, on the Russian-occupied railroad to Berlin, where people, he said, was like totally destroyed, like nothing, pummeled, like people living in holes in the ground with rats. And, you know, you can get good money for food. And so he would, like, keep going back and forth to Berlin. And they were doing great that way. I mean, he was supporting, like, six or seven people in a house and making sure that everybody's okay until July, August of 1945, when about 35 miles east, the Polish people killed hung three of his cousins. And there were progressive. Because I'm telling you, there was anti-Semitism in Poland. And they killed him. And so he went there to bury them. And then after that, he's like, you know, like, we got to get out of here. This is not cool anymore, even though it's really good economically. So they went and lived in a town called Salzheim, which is outside of Frankfurt am Main, which was a Jewish refugee camp under American auspices in the American-controlled portion of Germany. And they stayed there for about 2 years, where he also was doing black marketing, until they decided to move to the United States.
Well, he was definitely an entrepreneur, and he just, hats off to him.
You know the amazing part? He grew up in the 1920s and 30s when communism was really a big deal in Poland. I mean, it was hot stuff, hot communism. Yeah, it was some of that in the United States, too. So he went to all these communist parties and communist events and, you know, socialist and pro-socialist. He also went to a lot of Zionist events. But he, like, thought of himself as a socialist. And I would have the biggest arguments with that. Dad, you are not a socialist. You are a capitalist. I mean, you try to pay the least, you try to make the most, and you're telling me that, and yet he would vote Democrat and he was a socialist, but he was the biggest capitalist I ever met. And he did not agree with the fact that his ideology was he was a socialist. But, you know, would he want to give a penny to anybody? No, except the synagogue. He would give to the synagogue. That's one place where he felt pretty charitable.
That's pretty funny. I have some really bad news, though, gentlemen. We have about 5 minutes left in tonight's show, and then we're going to get cut off. I think we could talk about this for another 3 or 4 hours. I'm fascinated by your both of your parents, but your father sounds like a bit of a rascal, but he sounds like he really was.
I really was started writing the book was just about him, but then it was no way that I couldn't intertwine my mother's life into it. It was no way.
Oh,
and, you know, she passed away about almost a year ago. In fact, this past Sunday was her unveiling, and a big loss for me, big loss.
Oh, I'm sure.
Very smart lady. The one thing I'll say about my mother is that, you know, with all the people that survived, the people that died, if she was supposed to go to high school and college, her sister was going to pay for it. This was a loss of a professional mind, of developing someone's mind. So many minds were lost. I mean, I think we could have lost the cure for cancer, you know, three
exactly.
Nobel Prizes, all these people that died, that what they could have produced. And my mother, you know, she was a great mom. She worked hard. She helped support me and my brother. But had she had the opportunity to go to school, I would have watched out and how successful she could have been, because she had a tremendous memory. She was very quick, very tough. It was a loss. This is some of the losses that, you know, you think about the 6 million that were lost, the lives of the people that were survived, whose life was totally turned around.
Yes.
Yeah, it's sad because people don't seem to understand that what they do to one human being has a ripple effect to every generation that comes after.
Yeah, very well said.
Well, I'm definitely going to want to talk to you another time and get some tips and hints about psoriasis. That's kind of exciting.
I know that's something I know a lot about. I'm spending 38 years on that subject, you know, more than I did on the book. But, you know, I'm really happy.
How long did it take you to write the book?
What's that? Oh, it took me 3 years.
You said you started it 5 years ago?
Yeah, about five. So it took me 3 years to write it, 1 year to publish it.
Oh.
You know, it wasn't a full-time endeavor. I was still working, you know, so I had to do that. But, you know, I'm really happy with it. I'm really happy with it. I mean, it got across what I wanted to. I think people that read it realize it's not a hard book for some people, it's an emotionally difficult book.
Well,
and,
I will tell you, for me, I'm an avid reader, and I love to do book reviews. It's one of those books that it covers all of the emotions. It makes you – there are points where you have to laugh, especially when your dad was concerned. There are points when you have to cry, and there are points that you just kind of ponder a little bit and think, wow, that's powerful. You did a good job on that book. I know your parents are proud of you, and they're smiling down wherever they are, and just delighted to have you as their son.
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity.
You're very welcome. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be in touch.
Okay. Have a good evening.
Good evening. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
All right. See ya.
If you like the show tonight, let us know. Call 321-417-4309 or email mary@beunique.org to ask how you can sponsor the show. It's simple and doesn't have to cost much at all. Visit beunique.org for even more details. That's BUNEKE.org. Join the global world changers who already know how Be Unique helps bring together like-minded humans who are making the world a better place. Read the magazine and blog posts, watch our videos, listen to our podcast, and visit our social media from one location, and let's work together. Change tomorrow by finding solutions today. Visit BeUnique.org to learn more. That's BUNEKE.org.